This is the intro to obviously the podumentary that we've put together. The first part, no doubt, of a few, probably going into 2026. Now, if you listen to this, I don't know when this will actually be released, but possibly December, maybe. I don't know. Or ASAP. Because what the idea behind this podcast was that me and Matt over the past couple of years anyway, I've amalgamated a lot of information that has linked together, and he throws me stuff and I run with it in a one direction, and I throw back stuff back to him and he runs with it in a different direction. And this is the culmination of that work, I suppose. And the idea behind this podcast was just to press go, press record and see where it went. We knew we were going to get a lot of information, especially with our Chris throwing stuff in as well. And it went great, didn't it, Matt?
Yeah, it did. It did. I liked it. You sent me a copy of it after you recorded it, and I listened back to it, and I liked it. And the whole concept was, when we talked about doing this months and months back, this goes back. What is it today? The 12th of November, we're recording this intro, but we've been talking about this since what? Before the summer, about doing
Yeah,
this
I reckon before
Ashes
that, well
thing.
before that. I bet it's going on. It won't be 12 months, but close to 12 months, I reckon, if we look back at the emails.
I didn't realize it was that far back, but I wanted to do an Ashes thing, linking the Ashes, the Elliott family, to the Beatles. There are already connections there between the Beatles and the Ashes that a lot of people know about, but it goes far, far deeper. And I think we've discovered a lot of this that other researchers haven't. So we've been looking into this for a few months, planning this. When we were talking on the phone about recording what you're going to hear in this first installment, a little bit after this intro, in fact, what you're going to hear, the way I wanted it to be recorded was like the way you recorded your Huxley's series, like a conversation. And you said, all right, then that's how we'll do it. We'll just press record and see how it goes. Just have a conversation. So that's what we did. We had a conversation, but listening back to it, I loved it. But listening back to that recording of that first installment
When you
we're
press
going to
record,
hear,
there's never any structure to it. That's the problem.
there's never any structure. So it was like spillage of information, all great stuff, but it needs context. And I think this intro, I need to do it to feel
So you can
comfortable.
sleep
I need
easier.
to do this so I could, so I don't go slashing my wrist.
Well, I mean, people say to me, "Can you show me how you do your research?" And it's really. I got an email last week from someone. It's impossible because nobody's shown me how to do it, and nobody's shown you how to do it. Nobody's shown Mark Devlin how to do it, or Mike Williams, or
No.
anybody. And we all come at it from slightly different ways. Some of us go into hell of a lot of detail. Some of us just pull the surface off and throw loads of it out at people. And none of it's good or bad. It's just all like Dave McGowan, for instance. When you look at Dave McGowan's book now, I look at it and I think that was like the key in the door. That wasn't everything, was it? That was the key in the door
No,
to open
no,
it up and say,
no.
"Look, guys, I think Mark said it on an email, didn't he? Look, guys, if you want to go in this door, there's more, you know, as that comedian said, there's more.
Come here.
come here, there's more." And there's a whole lot more. Scarily.
I don't know when Dave McGowan wrote the Laurel Canyon book, if he knew there was more, but he didn't want to go deeper, or I
I think
don't know. Be
that's as deep as he could go at that particular point.
maybe, because since then, I've found out more stuff. More information
And
about
that's
certainly
not, I,
the
yeah, I'm not
doors. I've found out
disparaging,
much more.
I'm not disparaging
No, I'm
Dave's
not.
work, by the way. It was
No, not at
brilliant.
all. No way. That's a benchmark. That for me, that is a benchmark work that has directed my work since he released that book. That has inspired me to go in a
Yes, and me
particular
as well.
direction. And I'm looking at the British counterculture of the 60s, the equivalent of what happened in London. As it's basically the British equivalent of what he was looking at in Laurel Canyon. So mine is the British equivalent of the American version of what he was doing. So
And
that's because of him.
I'm hovering around somewhere in and around all of it, if you like,
You are.
because my interest wasn't what your interest is, obviously. It's just that
Which is
some
the
of the
Beatles in the 60s. That's my
exactly,
th
yeah. But my interest was more the intelligence side of it and the genealogy side of it. Not just of the 60s, but really anybody that takes your fancy, if you like, if that's the best phrase. But there's no way you can show people how, like, we're recording this now at 20 to 11 at night. Okay. I often speak to Matt, and he's been up till 4 o'clock doing, and later doing research like this. Then he gets something, goes to work. So if there's one thing I can say to people about research without just going on about this for ages, is tenacity is key.
You've got to want to do it. You've got to want to do it. Because if you don't want to do it, you won't be able to do it. Because you
And
have to,
you
because otherwise
and
you'll have to force yourself to do it. And
yes,
it's a
and
lot of hard work in, there's a lot of hard work involved.
I don't
And if
think
you
you
have
could
to
force yourself
force
to do it.
yourself, no, you couldn't. You couldn't. That's what I mean. You know, you have to want to do it. I've said this to you before on the phone. And it sounds a bit sick, might sound a little bit, but I'm not coming from that particular direction. I'm not saying I'm sick in the head or anything, but I actually or maybe I am. I actually get a kick out of it doing this
Well, I enjoy
research.
it. Yeah,
I enjoy
I enjoy
it, you
it.
know.
Is that a bad thing to enjoy
I don't
doing
know because I
research?
listen to some researchers and they say that they have to go away for a bit. They have to take a break because otherwise it'll bring them down.
I've never
And
had to do that.
I see, but I've never had to do that.
Do you know what it is, Matt? I think some people can handle an amount of information, and even if I have a quiet day and don't do loads, I'm probably unraveling what I've just learned, if you like, and then blah, it comes back out again. And we've all got our own ways, but I can't really say I've ever had to step away because it's got too much.
No, I
More I've had to
haven't.
figure something
So
out,
which,
maybe, as opposed to it's got too much. But
yeah,
anyway.
which is why I sometimes think if I'm sick in the head because I'll see videos of certain researchers speaking on their YouTube presentations and they say, "Oh, I had to take a break because it was getting too much for me." And I think a lot of people do that. They have to, and I'm sitting there thinking, but I don't do that. Is there something wrong with
And
me?
again,
There
maybe that's
must be something wrong with me.
a bit, but maybe that's just their way, and that's fine. Everyone's got their own way. It's just I know when I was in business, I had a similar attitude. I was tenacious, yeah. And all I've done is, since I became ill, when I got ill with Lyme, is change my direction from business to researching health initially and this stuff, yeah. So it's just in my mindset, it's the same principle. In business, you're looking for opportunities, and in research, you're looking for opportunities.
Yeah, you are. Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. And every time you find a gem, you get a
Yes.
buzz out of it. You do.
And you've got to be willing not to find the answer to what you.
Yeah.
I think that's what fries people's minds, Matt. My wife says to me, "I don't know how you can do what you do, because I've got to find an answer." She's from an accounts background, so 2 add 2 is 4. And that adds up every time in on a sheet of paper. Whereas we do research, and we might find all this information that you're going to listen to over the next 2.5 hours, but there's not really a definitive answer. You just,
There
every
isn't.
time.
Yeah, that's what I sometimes say in my videos when I put something together for my websites. I say in between it or before I start it or at the end of it, I'll say, look, I'm just putting together the info. All I've done is put together the information, put it out there, and it's up to you what you think of it or what you want to do with it. Take parts of it if you want and go off in another direction. Use some of it for your own research or disregard the whole lot. I'm not here to give you an agenda, basically. I'm not here standing on a platform representing a political view, if you like. This is the information I'm bringing to you. Do what with it. Do with it what you will. Sometimes a lot of my sometimes some of the articles I put together don't have an answer at the end of it. I'm just saying, look, this is what I've found. What do you think? It looks a bit strange. It looks a bit dodgy. But
Also,
I don't get to the end of the article with a conclusion. Do you know what I mean?
yes.
There isn't a beginning, middle, and an end. There's a
Yes.
beginning, there's definitely a middle, but
Yeah.
there's not necessarily an end, you know?
No, also, there's two types of presentation that you can do. You can do opinion-based based presentation, which is fair enough. There's nothing
Fair
wrong with that.
enough.
Nothing wrong with having an opinion. And there's also research where you're searching out certain truths. Doesn't mean to say what them truths mean that person's a bad or a good person. It just means that they're the truths surrounding that person, i.e., Ian Fleming's family owned a international bank, and they were an international banking cartel. That's the truth. You know, it might not be. What we're saying is it's never advertised that that's the truth. It's that, when you read about Ian Fleming, they don't tell you they owned a bank that they sold for £7 billion. They never say that.
Yeah, so then you've got to ask yourself, why? Why
Yes.
aren't they telling you
Why?
that? You
And
know,
then you link
why?
all the intelligence connections to that one person and Masonic links and all these other things. And you think, well, how can that happen by chance? How does that? And that's what we're leaving open for people to decide, I suppose, with this research, with Bertrand Russell, for instance, that when you see that Bertrand Russell and his family were the Dukes of Tavistock and all the land they owned in or around the area where the Tavistock Hospital, that you found out, the Tavistock Hospital
The
was
clinic,
built and the clinic and the whole thing, that's got to raise eyebrows, at least in
It
some.
has to,
It has to do, hasn't it?
it has to. It's this area in London called Bloomsbury, where, well, you'll hear it in the video, the 2 hours, 45 minutes of it, or whatever it is, however long
Yeah,
it is.
probably about 5 hours after we finish this intro, this short intro.
5 days. You'll find out, you'll find out what links Bertrand Russell to Tavistock and all of that, and London, and a particular area of London called Bloomsbury, where a lot of the 60s British counterculture movement was born from, and was you know, when it kicked off, when it
And
became
ironically, it
big.
wasn't born in the 60s, it was born in the 50s. Yeah, really.
Even
Even before that, even beyond that.
Sort of the roots were probably even before that, the seeds of it, I should say. But what you were saying before about why hasn't Ian Fleming, why didn't Ian Fleming or anyone connected to his family or his associates ever mention this banking background? You'll find in the video to come and in subsequent episodes, when you look at the links that link the Elliot Asher family to the Beatles, why haven't they ever mentioned any of these links that we're going to mention?
Yes.
Why haven't they? Some of them you could probably say, aha, well, we know why they didn't mention that, because it's a little bit dodgy. But there's certain other elements where you think, well, why haven't they ever told us this? Why haven't they said anything? You know, why haven't they told us about this particular aspect of the Beatles that links to the Asher or the Elliot family or
In the
somebody
story, it
else,
is
you know?
quite important, isn't it? You know,
It's
in
quite important. You think, and if
the
they've got nothing to hide, why not just say it? You know,
Why not
why haven't they
say
said anything? Yeah, why have they left it to idiots like us 60 years later
it?
to sitting in our little, you know, sad little dens, you know,
Yeah.
coming up with it? What, you know, does it, is this what it needs for it to come out? You know, and if so, why? Why won't they tell us? Why didn't they tell us?
Why isn't it important that the Elliots actually had their own lodge? Why isn't that important to tell people? Among other things, there's about 100 things. I mean, bloody hell, I did with Mike Williams four hours at least. I mean, we're probably going to destroy that in two bloody
Oh,
episodes.
yeah, easy, easy. Yeah.
We've only covered Bertrand Russell in this one, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know when you see the one that we do about the Doors, that you're going to say we need to add that into the mix as well.
Yeah.
Because the bloodlines match up with
Yeah.
the Elliots and what have you, the counterculture, you know, that even David Crosby's bloodline matches up in Scotland, which a lot of these bloodlines seem to head back to Scotland, don't they, as well.
Yeah, they do. And I'm going to mention that in just a few minutes,
Right.
actually, as part of my intro to bring us all,
Oh, we're
because
still
I
on
want to bring
the
some context. I've actually
intro.
typed out a kind of improvised script type of
Right.
thing, because I don't want to forget anything. I
Yeah,
think
yeah.
this is really important to me to get this information out before we go on to the actual first episode. Because I have to, because otherwise
Go
I'll
for it.
forget stuff, and then
Go for it.
afterwards I'm going to say to myself in a couple of days' time, "Oh, I didn't mention that.
You
You know, why
see,
didn't I mention that?" So I need to type it out.
and that's probably what I type stuff out as well. For this, I haven't, because I did that on the presentations I did for Mike. I write,
Yeah.
people don't realize that you write sort of like a script, and
You have to.
it has to be read like in a timeline, and the storyline and the
It does.
information
Otherwise, you
inbox.
lose it. It confuses people. If it's
Yes.
a big subject, it will confuse people.
And
And it's not because
that's,
people are thick as shite. It's
yeah,
because it's
information
gargantuan.
overload. That's
It
why.
is. It's information overload.
Also, and that's
Overload.
why when I present my whatever the documentaries, Gareth Icke called them documentaries, so I'll stick with that one. I
Yeah,
don't
they
mind
are.
that.
Yeah, they are. They are.
I like to put the information and add the video in. So when we're talking about a subject, I will put the proof up on the screen.
Yeah. I tend to do that with a lot of
Yeah.
my videos
Yeah.
as well. Yeah.
This
Yeah.
video took me 8 hours to put together. This video
Wow.
took me 8 hours.
That's quick. That's really good. Normally when
Yeah.
I put one together, it takes about
I can't believe
4 months.
that. Yeah, but
No, you can't really.
it took me about 8 hours. I did that one and the doors in the same week. So
Yeah.
that took me about
Wow.
six. The doors were a bit shorter because it. So last week, I did both of those. I wanted to get them out of the
Yeah.
way.
Well, the Doors one would have taken shorter because I had nothing to do with
Yeah, but yeah. But only a couple of
it.
hours short. But that's why. That's
Okay.
because when my brain's going, I can't stop it. It's just
Yeah.
going, you know.
Yeah.
I know you know what it's like. But anyway, all right.
Yeah, I
Crack on
do.
with
Okay. So
your
basically,
intro. We're only 20 minutes in.
yeah, only 20 minutes. Okay. So basically, this Asher series that we're about to watch, well, in about 5 or 10 or so minutes' time, is the first installment. And it's basically a collection of connections that some might put down as merely, you know, quote
Coincidence.
unquote, coincidence. But others, of course, will say it goes way, 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 way too far and too deep for it to be mere chance. And actually, it's preordained, arranged, you might say. And I certainly feel that way. And I've never, I, do you know what? In all the years I've been researching and putting together articles and podcasts, I don't think I can say that I've ever been this certain that these so-called coincidences that we've got coming up in this first installment and installments to come, I've never been so certain as to say this is nothing. That this is that, that this is I'm 99.9% sure that this is not coincidence. It can't be. It just can't be. So as I'll mention, you'll see us in the early parts of the first installment talking about a sketch that I've drawn, literally a pencil drawn sketch of a wheel. And the middle part of that wheel is basically the entity that is the Beatles. And by entity, what I mean is what the Beatles were, what they represented. So that could be the songwriting name that is Lennon and McCartney, the Beatles' promotion of LSD, of transcendental meditation, and much, much more. You'll see it. You'll see it in the first installment. So you've got in the middle of this wheel, you've got the entity that's the Beatles, and then you've got these spokes coming out, these representations, as I say. These are the spokes of that wheel that essentially created what was and what we regard to be the Beatles, and what helped to make the 60s, the 1960s in the so-called Western world, what it was and how we perceive it today. And a lot of that lives on to this day. We feel the effects of it in our society today. But the thing is, what makes this so potent is the fact that every single one of those spokes, every single one, links to the Asher family, or to be more precise, the maternal side of that family, the Elliots. But it's the same thing, really. So every spoke of that wheel that makes the Beatles, what they were as an entity, and more importantly, how that entity of the Beatles changed society. Every spoke of that wheel, and I mean every spoke of that wheel, connects to the Ashes
And
and
we're
or
adding
the
more spokes.
Elliots.
We're adding more spokes as
Yeah,
well, so
all
it's.
the time, all the time. We're learning as we're going along with this series. So just
We sound
a
like
little bit of
AI. Possibly AI,
Someone's
aren't we?
actually said
Well,
that. Someone actually said I was a bot. Someone said
right.
to Mark Devlin after I was on one of his shows, he said, "Are you sure that Matt Sergio isn't a bot? Because
Yeah.
I was just coming out with so much information." That is the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Okay, so a little bit of I know this might sound hard to believe because I know that probably the vast majority of people watching this or listening to this will know who the Ashes are and what their connection is to the Beatles, like the surface level of that. There is, of course, we're going to go deep, 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 and there's going to be a lot of stuff that people aren't aware of. But I think, but just in case there are some people who are not sure of what these specific connections are to the Beatles with regards to the Ashes, there's so we've got Jane Asher, who is a well-known British TV, movie, and stage actress, and she was involved in a long-term relationship with Paul McCartney between 1963 to 1968, and there was even talk that they were going to get married. And between 1963 to 66 or thereabouts, he lived with her at her family home at 57 Wimpole Street in London. And that's important. We've got to make note of that because that is something that's going to be talked about in later episodes. And he lived there with Jane and also her brother, musician Peter Asher, their dad, Richard Asher, Dr. Richard Asher, and mum, Margaret, whose maiden name was Elliot. And of course, Dr. Richard died in suspicious circumstances in 1969, and we'll be talking about that in future episodes. Now, of course, as many people watching this, listening to this, will know, the most commonly known of the coincidences linking the Ashes to the Beatles is George Martin, the Beatles record producer, the man who produced their hit songs and who's been dubbed the fifth Beatle. I think that's
There's quite
important
a
to
few of
note
them,
as
isn't there?
well.
There's
Yeah,
about 10
but
Fifth
it,
Beatles.
yeah, that, exactly. But the reason I mention this is that Paul McCartney, when George Martin died a few years ago, Paul McCartney put up on a Twitter post, he said, if anyone was the fifth Beatle, it was George Martin.
You
So
would say
coming
that,
from
wouldn't you?
him,
Yeah, you would say that. Yeah.
yeah. So
Yeah.
now here's the coincidence, quote unquote coincidence. Here's one of them. This is the most well-known one, but I'm just putting it out there just in case there's anyone listening to this who's not aware of it. Now, some 15 years or so before he met the Beatles and became their producer, he just so happened to have been having private oboe lessons from none other than Margaret Asher. So 15 years before George Martin met the Beatles, 15 years before one of those Beatles went on to be romantically involved with Margaret Asher's daughter, Jane, George Martin was getting oboe lessons from Margaret. Fancy
I
that.
mean, when you read that, I mean, that alone should ring alarm bells,
Yeah.
because the law of averages says that that just can't happen. It might happen in a fl you know, he teaches oboe, then bumps into Paul McCartney and John Lennon, but not becomes integral in their life.
Yeah,
In
goes
the
on to date
establishment,
the daughter of the mother of the teacher, and it's London as well. So how many music teachers would there have been in London? I don't know, maybe there weren't so many oboe teachers in. I
I
mean,
can't
it's
see
quite a.
that. Yeah, I would have thought there'd been a few floating about. But anyway,
Yeah, anyway.
that alone should set alarm bells. But that is
Yeah.
out there. That's a quite a well-known
That's
one, isn't
out
it?
there, yeah. So as I said before, most people who look into this, who are interested in this subject, will know this already. But I'm just putting it out there just in case there are some people listening to this who are thinking, why we what's the point of this series, this gargantuan series these guys are doing? So that's, I'm just putting it out there for context so people can get an idea of why we're doing this. But it's also, again, we'll be going into great detail about this in future episodes, I think, I would dare to say. But I think it's also important for the sake of context now in this intro to mention Margaret's side of the family, the maternal side of the Asher family, the Elliots, because they're not your run-of-the-mill family. So essentially, from what I've been able to
I actually
decipher.
think, Matt, just to stop you a second, I actually think this is what got me looking at the Ashes, because what I when I saw when I was looking and doing the Huxley's The Brave New World Order series, which this is sort of a spin-off from the Huxley Brave New World Order.
It
It
is.
has to be included in that world for me, for or from a sheep fan perspective, because Huxley's obviously on one of the Beatles album cover, Sergeant Pepper, A Lonely Heart,
Yeah.
Lonely Hearts. And I thought I'll look into all the people that are on that. That terrified me because I thought I'm mad enough without looking into about I don't know how many people are on
I can't remember
that,
now, 50,
but
50 or
some
something,
50 odd,
maybe. I don't know.
yeah. I thought that will take me on my life to do. So then you said, "Why did, have you ever looked at Jane Asher's genealogy?" You actually said that to me. I think it
Oh, did
was
I? I can't remember that.
last December, or you sent me over that she'd done an interview and she was related to King Richard.
Oh, yeah.
That,
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
is what got me on looking at Jane Asher. And
Yeah.
then, and the Elliott family.
Yeah. And
So it's your fault.
yeah, it's my fault. I don't mind. It keeps you off the
I'd have
streets,
only found
doesn't
something else.
it? Exactly. Keeps you off the streets, mate. So, yeah, essentially, I'm not going to go into the full family tree. I'm going to explain a little. I'm going to sort of give you a brief sketch of it, but I'm not going to go, like, I'm not going to go into full detail.
We can't
As I
match the
say,
intro.
we can't. This is for future episodes. And I know this is your particular side of speciality that you're going to want to dive
Chuffing,
deep
no,
into as
we're
well.
both into this, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose. But this is more your thing, sort of family trees and stuff.
If I send you over what I've done, like we did with the Boyds, you'll probably run off in another direction with some of the stuff, which is worrying in its own right, to be honest with you, because
And I'll get onto them in a minute, actually, as well. The boys, got to mention them because they do connect. So basically, from what I've been able to decipher with regards to the Elliots, and this is actually according to the Elliots themselves over the generations in books that they've researched and written about their own family line. So this is a lot of this information I've picked out is according to them. Okay. The Elliot bloodline, okay, the one that we're most interested in, and that we're going to be focusing in on mostly, I think, is the British bloodline. That's the one I've been focusing on anyway. So basically what happened, what we're told is it goes back to 1066, the Norman invasion of England by William the Conqueror. And accompanying him on that invasion was one of his knights, who was Sir William de Aliot. So that's Aliot. And his descendants initially settled in Devon, where they flourished for about 8 or 10 generations, from what I can make out. And then they moved to Cornwall, where they then established themselves and where they still basically are, where the main family seat is, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And Peter and Jane Asher's mum, Margaret Elliot, derives from this particular family line. So,
And it's an important line as well. It's not
oh,
just.
hugely. And I'll get to that in a moment because this is not some run-of-the-mill family. But as well as the English Elliots, you kind of touched on it earlier, as well as the ones that have settled in Cornwall, there's the Scottish Elliots. Now, some say that the Scottish Elliots are unrelated. They've said that that they're unrelated to the English line, that they're actually the Elliots in Scotland are actually named after a village that's there. However, other sources say no, the Scottish Elliots and the English Elliots are actually blood related, with their roots going back to that knight, Sir William de Aliot, who came over with William the Conqueror. And this is actually according to some of the Elliots that have looked into their own bloodline in various books that you can find online. You can find these free online. You can read them for yourself. So even their family, the Elliots in England, have said no, the Scottish line is connected. So here we go then. Not your run-of-the-mill family, by any shot at all, however far you throw the ball. So quick rundown of the Cornwall Elliot line, the direct descendants of Jane and Peter Asher. So the Cornwall Elliot line, from what I can make out, it began in 1620 with John Elliot of Port Elliot in St. Germans in Cornwall. Now Port Elliot was a priory that the Elliots purchased in St. Germans, and they named it Port Elliot. So they bought it and gave it that name. John Elliot was born in 1590. He was educated at Oxford, surprise, surprise, knighted in 1618, and he was a member of Parliament in Britain. So he was an MP, a British politician. More MPs followed in subsequent generations of the Elliots, and eventually the Elliots of Cornwall were made into earls and barons as well. There were also Elliots in the line between the 1700s and 1800s who worked closely within British government as well, as well as being members of Parliament.
You tend to find in that era, them eras that you've spoke about, from 1066 up to that 18th
17,
century,
1800s, yeah.
that if they had three or four boys, one would be the in line to inherit the earldom or the dukedom. The other one would go into politics. One might go into the military or go into religion. So what they're doing is they're covering all the control
Yeah.
bases.
Or one might even become a philosopher, quote
Yeah,
unquote
exactly.
philosopher, or an
Professor.
intellectual, or yeah, or an artist or something like that. But just one example of there's Edward Granville Elliot, Earl of St. Germans, born in 1798. So he was a former MP. He was also, here we go, a Lord of the Treasury, ambassador to Spain, postmaster general, chief secretary for Ireland, and Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. So quite a resume. And then there was Edward James Elliot, and he married the daughter of William Pitt, the British Prime Minister, between 1766 and 1768. So yeah,
And
not your
William Pitt owned Ch Chatham House. I think I
it
remember.
was it was it Chatham House? Oh, interesting. Yeah, it just never stops, does it? Bloody never stops. And I think this is a good point here to mention another lady who was romantically involved with a Beatle during the 60s and who features in this wheel that we're going to see, this sketch, this wheel. And she comes under the subheading of meditation. So where you see the spoke in my sketch where it says meditation,
You need some
I
coloring
did
pens
have,
as well.
I actually had a question mark next to hers. All the spokes coming out of the wheel, I had an answer for. I sort of wrote in pencil, yeah, that's the ashes. Yeah, they've got a hand in that. Yes, this spoke here, yeah, they've got a hand in that. When it came to meditation, I had a question mark, but I've since been able to answer that. And yeah, so basically, we've got to mention this other lady that's involved. So we've got Jane Asher, who was going out with a Beatle in the 60s. So she's Asher Elliot bloodline. But there's also another lady at the time in the 60s, who not only dated a Beatle, she married a Beatle, and that's Patty Boyd. She married George Harrison in 1966. Why mention Patty? Well, you'll find out later in this instalment, in this first instalment. But just to give you a taster, according to the Scots Peerage, a book that looks at the old so-called elite bloodlines, the Boyd bloodline that Patty is related to is part Irish and, here we go, Scottish. Now, to be more precise, it's part of the Earl of Kilmarnock bloodline in Scotland. That's the Boyd bloodline that she belongs to. According to Scots Peerage, the first in that so-called elite line was Robert Boyd, who fought for Robert the Bruce, loyally for Robert the Bruce, the King of the Scots. He fought alongside him in the Scottish War for Independence against England. He also is said to have fought for Sir William Wallace for Scottish independence as well. And it's said that as a reward for his loyalty and service to that cause, he was knighted and became Sir Robert Boyd. I think this was sometime in the early 1300s or something. And later generations of the Boyds were made lords and earls, especially of Kilmarnock in Scotland. Yeah, another name we'll be mentioning is T.S. Eliot, the American-born poet, because according to none other than Jane Asher herself, she's actually said that T.S. Eliot was related to her mum, Margaret. Now, you said that Margaret Eliot and T.S. Eliot were cousins.
Yes, cousins, yes.
Were they
Cousins.
cousins? Yeah. Okay. And he was also a friend of British so-called philosopher Bertrand Russell, who's the key figure in this first instalment to come. So you've got T.S.
I think
Eliot.
T.S. Eliot actually lived with Bertrand Russell.
He did. He did. He did. Yeah. They lived together
You're giving
in
the game away
Bloomsbury
a
in
bit there.
London, giving the game away a little bit. No. I'm going to mention, well, it's all going to come out. Yeah. In Bloomsbury in London, I think, well, we talk about it in the first instalment later on. You'll hear us talking about it. I think Bertrand Russell, it's said that when he was a lecturer, I think it was at Harvard in the early part of the 20th century, he taught T.S. Eliot, and they became friends. And then when T.S. Eliot came over to England, he actually lived in Bertrand Russell's apartment in Bloomsbury in London, which is called Russell Chambers. I think that was the name of the
It
building.
would be impossible that the Dukes of Bedford, the Dukes of Tavistock, the Russells would not know the Earls of Saint Germain or Saint Germain. That is impossible.
And they're both supporters of, they were both supporters of eugenics as well,
Yes.
T.S. Eliot and Bertrand Russell. But here's the thing, this is the reason why we're mentioning Bertrand Russell in this first installment, because certainly from my research, having looked into the British counterculture scene of over the last, well, I've been looking at it for the last, what, 10 years or so, Bertrand Russell, I can pretty much say, you know, I'm pretty much 99.9% certain that he was regarded as, and is regarded as, a forefather of the 1960s British counterculture, even though at the time in the 1960s he was in his late 80s, well into his, I think he was well into his 90s
Yeah.
by that point,
I mean, I would
actually.
say he's just as important as Aldous Huxley.
Yeah, even more so,
Yeah.
maybe, even more so. I would call him the grandfather, actually, of the 1960s British counterculture. I don't know about stateside. And of course, the Beatles were the champions. They were the promoters of the counterculture,
That's
the
without doubt
1960s
now, isn't it? That
counterculture.
really.
That's without
That,
doubt. They
yeah.
made a, they said it themselves at the time. They championed everything that came out of the counterculture, whatever it was, whether it was drugs or, you know, flower power, as it was called, or the music. The Beatles were waving the flag for it at the time. They
Because
didn't make any secret of it.
the Beatles, if you look at, say, Oasis or Blur, they still, when Blur ever went on tour, they don't change like the Beatles did. No, the band changed. They went from wearing suits or leather jackets to suits to growing the hair long. Oasis never did that, or Blur, or any of these other bands never do it. You know, Ed Sheeran or whatever you want to call it. They never changed like that, ever.
It's like some people say, and I think there's some merit to this, and I've looked into this in some videos myself, that the Beatles, the reason there's this theory that the reason the Beatles chose the group name The Beatles is because it's partly derived from the actual beetle, the scarab beetle, the insect, which in ancient Egypt was this revered symbol, which it stood for a lot of things. It was like a god. It was a revered deity in ancient Egypt. And okay, the Beatles changed, you know, the way the group name The Beatles is spelt is BEAT. But when they actually started, when they chose that name, they actually spelt it as the insect, the beetle. It's only later on they changed the spelling of it. Now, there is this theory that I find quite arresting, if you like, that the reason they chose that name, whether subconsciously or consciously, is because the scarab beetle is a symbol of rebirth. It's a symbol of many things. It's also a sun symbol, which is interesting, according to ancient Egyptian the belief system of the ancient Egyptians. But it's also seen as rebirth, because what a scarab beetle does is it rolls its own dung into a ball, which is like a so basically it takes its own waste and it rolls its eggs inside the dung, its own eggs inside the dung. So out of waste comes new life, basically. I think that's what happens. I think, if my memory serves me correctly. So in that sense, what you're getting there is rebirth. You're getting something out of death being born. So out of waste, you're getting some new
Yeah, makes
life. So
sense. Yeah.
it's a symbol of rebirth. And if you look at the Beatles, that's what they were doing constantly throughout their career. They were being reborn constantly, over and over the years. So they start off in the 50s as this teenage band who are a skiffle group in the 50s, like a schoolboy band, and this kind of music style that's called skiffle. Then they ditch that and they become this. They start playing rock and roll, Elvis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry covers, and then they go to Hamburg and play in the clubs of Hamburg, and they start wearing leathers, and they become this kind of raucous, uncouth, raw kind of rock and roll band, wearing leather trousers and leather jackets, smoking on stage, swearing, spitting, that kind of thing. Sort of early punk, if you like. Then their manager discovers them, Brian Epstein. He remolds them into these cute, cuddly, lovable mop tops that mop top haircutted Beatles appearing in front of the Queen on stage, and with teenage girl fans, kids chasing after them, and they become this kind of all-round family entertainer type group. And then as the sort of counterculture period comes in and acid begins to seep into the culture, if you like, they become psychedelic. They become these kind of gods of psychedelia, Sergeant Pepper, if you like. There they are, decked out in all their acid finery. And then towards the end of their career, they drop all that, and they go back to how they were right at the beginning, sort of wearing jeans and long hair and beards and playing old rock and roll kind of thing. So they were constantly being born, dying, sort of rebirth constantly throughout their career. So yeah, you're spot on there.
And the Beatles really now are becoming peripheral because, I know it sounds a bit mad, because the Ashes, really, their story, their connections are actually bigger than the individuals inside the band.
Yeah. So
And
they were kind of the band, or what became the entity, the Beatles,
the
were
brand,
the
yeah.
vehicle, in which to move ahead this agenda, this social agenda.
Yeah.
And if you think that Bertrand Russell, as I say, was like this forefather of the British counterculture movement, so in the same breath, when you think, you've also got Peter Asher, Jane Asher's brother. So we're talking here about, because they're related, the Russells and the Ashers are related.
And
Yeah,
that's
Peter.
another one of those coincidences, just like Peter Asher, just like Peregrine Elliott. All of these people, is it Peregrine Elliott who ran Salt
Yeah,
Deep? Yeah.
Peregrine. Yeah.
All of these people are around the Ashes are all
Yeah.
related. That's that was
Yeah.
one of
So,
the that was one of the whacks around the face with a wet fish for me and you, that moment
yeah.
where we realised that all of these people aren't just there, they're all related.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you've got Peter Asher, who,
They're all cousins and brothers.
the point is that Peter Asher, Jane Asher's brother, he was also a champion of the counterculture, same as Bertrand Russell. Whereas Bertrand Russell wasn't so direct with it, Peter Asher was, because he invested in a bookshop and a gallery, which became the kind of the epicenter, if you like, of the burgeoning British counterculture scene in London. And yeah, as I said a moment or two ago, the Elliots and the Ashers and and Bertrand Russell are actually bloodline connected. And I drew you a sketch ages ago, ages and ages ago, because sometimes when you're looking at genealogy, you'll know this, Dom. When you're putting together the genealogy of someone that you're trying to trace their genealogy, and you're doing it online, and you
It's
find
difficult, isn't
something,
it?
you think it's
Yeah,
difficult to keep
definitely.
abreast of it, because you
Yeah.
find something on a website, on a page, and it says so and so, that's his brother-in-law, and that was his wife, da 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 da. And then you press a link and it takes you to another page. You think, wait a minute, but I can't remember
Oh, that
what
was,
the other page
yeah.
said. So you find yourself having to write it down on a piece of paper, because otherwise you'll forget it all. Because in your head, all you've got in your head is brother-in-law, sister-in-law, grandmother, grandfather, and you're trying to remember it all, but
Yeah.
it's not in front of you on the
Do
computer
you know
because you
what?
pressed so many
That is one
links,
of,
it's disappeared.
I don't know if you get this, but that is one of the things that I can sort of envision where it's going. I remember, so when I come
I
across
can't do
certain,
it in my head. I have to
yeah.
write it down. I
So
have to write it
when I
down to
come across
remember.
names, I do it in a way that I use the male line first, although the female line's generally the most important one. I use the male line first and go to the end of the male line. Then come back to the first female and
Okay.
go forward, and then that way I learned over time, because I ended up doing what you were on about there,
Yeah.
that you end up losing where you were,
Yeah, you do. You do.
And you've got to go back and, but yeah, anyway,
Yeah, so yeah, so basically what I've
or
done to li I wanted to link, I found a link that links the Elliott stroke Ashes to Bertrand Russell,
And then
but
I
it was
found one
so,
exactly the same,
yeah, exactly. You
different
found one
times.
as well at different times, and it's basically the same. We found the same thing by doing it separately without knowing that either of us was doing it. But I had to sketch it out on two bits of A4, and I had to sellotape the middle because it was so gargantuan. And I've sent it to you, and hopefully we can put that up on the screen
Yes.
now
Yeah, hopefully we can.
so people can see it, because I actually mention it in the installment that's to come. There's a point where you say to me, or I say to you, oh yeah, because the Ashes and the Elliots are related to the Russells. And I say to you, oh yeah, I've got it somewhere here, but I can't find it at the minute, and I never did find it. So what I've done here is I've actually typed it out so I can read it to you. So, okay. And hopefully we'll get a shot of my sketch of the line, because it's huge. It is quite octopus-like. So this connection, okay, connecting the Elliot bloodline to Bertrand Russell. Right, I routed it to Henry Augustus Dillon Lee, 13th Viscount Dillon of Costello Galen, and I think that's how you pronounce it. So one of it, so here we go. One of his daughters, Henrietta Dillon Lee, married Edward John Stanley, 3rd Baron Stanley of Alderley, and one of their daughters, Catherine Louisa, married John Russell, Viscount Amberley, and they had two sons, one of whom was Bertrand Russell. Meanwhile, and this is, and you'll hear me mention this later on in the video, meanwhile, a sister of that earlier mentioned Henrietta Maria Dillon Lee, a sister of hers, Louisa Ann Rose Dillon, married the Right Honourable Sir Spencer Cecil Brabazon Ponsonby Fane, and one of their daughters, Constance Louisa, married William Robert Phelips, Phelips, whose daughter, Claire Louisa, married Edward Granville Elliot, who were the parents of Margaret Elliot, later to become Margaret Asher, Peter and Jane's mum. So that's how Bertrand Russell, grandfather of the 1960s British counterculture, is related by bloodline to the Ashes. And as I say, I mentioned this part of the family tree in the first installment to come. Incidentally, and this is worth mentioning too, Patty Boyd, who became Patty Harrison, is related to Bertrand Russell, and the Elliots through somebody called Lady Isabel Boyd. Lady Isabel Boyd, and I've got graphics for this, we can put this up as well. Lady Isabel Boyd was born sometime between 1600 and 1628. No one's actually absolutely sure. And she was the daughter of Robert Boyd of Kilmarnock. So here we've got this Kilmarnock
That's
thing
where
coming up
the
again.
aristocratic Kilmarnock line is.
So Lady Isabel Boyd's daughter Marion married Sir Archibald Coburn of Langton, 4th Baronet. Their daughter, Helen Jean Coburn, married Sir Robert Stewart of Allan Bank, 1st Baronet. And that's Stewart spelt Steuart. Some spellings come up in that style. Others don't.
No, I'll just come
Others
with the
come up.
W.
Yeah, others come with a W. So their daughter, so as I say, their daughter Helen, so Helen Jean Coburn married Sir Robert Stewart of Allan Bank, 1st Baronet. Helen Jean and Sir Robert's daughter, who was also named Helen, married Sir Gilbert Elliot, 2nd Baronet Minto. So this is an Elliot from the Scottish line, which we're told is related to the English Elliots, although some say it isn't, others say they are. The 2nd Baronet of Minto and Helen, one of their sons, who went on to become Sir Gilbert Elliot, 3rd Baronet of Minto, married Agnes Dalrymple Kinnunmound, and they had a son, Gilbert Elliot, 1st Earl of Minto. So there's the Boyd Elliot link. Okay, so we now have a link linking Patty Boyd and Jane Asher. Now, how Bertrand Russell links to this, Gilbert Elliot, 1st Earl of Minto, who is Lady Isabel Boyd's great 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 grandson, his son, the 2nd Earl of Minto, born in November 1782, went on to have a daughter, Frances Anna Maria Elliot Murray Kinnunmound. She married John Russell, 1st Earl Russell. Their son, John Russell, Viscount Amberley, went on to have two sons, one of whom was Bertrand Russell. So Bertrand Russell is related to the Boyds. And Lady Isabel Boyd, from what I can make out, is Bertrand Russell's great, 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 great grandmother. So Patty Boyd. So basically, after coming out with all of that at you, in summary, Patty Boyd, who married George Harrison, and Jane Asher, who was Paul McCartney's serious long-term girlfriend, and Bertrand Russell are all related to each other.
And that about sums it up, doesn't it?
That about sums it up.
Because, before we finish on this, are we done there with your notes or?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I sent you another picture of an old newspaper headline or a newspaper article. It's called Priests and Prophets of Permissiveness.
We'll stick that up now and
yeah,
you're
I'll
watching
stick
this.
That up now. So basically,
the intro won't be in as much depth as the documentary, but the stuff that Matt's talking about will stick up there on the screen as you're watching it.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically what we've got, hopefully what you've put up is a piece which is actually taken from the Guardian newspaper from October 1967. And the title reads Priests and Prophets of Permissiveness. So I've been saying that Bertrand Russell, according to my findings, is deemed to be a forefather of the British counterculture movement scene. And this newspaper article pretty much kind of confirms that in a way. So as you can see from the newspaper headline, Russell is deemed to be a priest and a prophet of the so-called permissive society of 60s Western culture. So the permissive society, so what we're talking about here back in the 60s was the loosening attitude towards sexual behavior, family values, childbirth, marriage, drug use, and so on. And if you look at this newspaper piece from The Guardian, so you've got Bertrand Russell, who is deemed to be a priest and prophet of permissiveness, his name sitting alongside Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and also a guy by the name of John Hopkins, who was John Hoppy Hopkins, who's someone I've looked into in great depth. And he was essentially and is essentially regarded as the de facto leader of the British counterculture movement. He was the man, whenever something happened within the British counterculture scene, some, like, say, for example, a nightclub event or a new kind of collective that was pushing the 60s counterculture movement, he was the man that was effectively making it happen. He was the go-getter. He was the doer, basically. And if you ask anyone who was involved, any key mover and shaker from the 60s counterculture scene, one of the key people, they will all say to you effectively that he was the key mover and shaker. So John Hopkins, the Beatles, Allen Ginsberg, Bob Dylan, they're all in this Guardian article, and many other names as well. And there, slap bang, right next to them is Bertrand Russell. So that's the regard he was given, even back in the 1960s, as this was going on. This was the regard that Bertrand Russell was given, his importance in the whole
movement.
60s movement, yeah, in Britain, yeah.
And I
sure.
think we'll see that when you listen to that, or when people listen to that audio clip that's going to be played in a little bit. The guy asking him the question is really sounding subservient to him and in awe of what Bertrand Russell is about to answer to his question. We're a good find that, Matt.
Thanks. Yeah, I love it when I find things like that. That's what
Oh, yeah, we all do,
gives me
man.
a buzz. Gives me a yeah. So
Piecing the
yeah,
jigsaw puzzle together.
Indeed. So yeah, you were saying earlier about Bertrand Russell. He gave T.S. Eliot, his friend, a flat in London to stay at. I don't know if they shared the flat together or whether he lent it to him or sublet it to him. I'm not exactly sure. But this was an area in London called Bloomsbury, which we'll also mention in the first instalment. And I think it's also worth mentioning that. And I've been there. I've actually made a video about all of this, and you can find it on my YouTube page, Conspiro TV, about this area in London. And I've actually been down there and done a kind of a kind of like in your face on the street, hot footing it with a video phone camera report on the whole thing. And I've hot footed it down there, literally. The flat where Bertrand Russell and T.S. Eliot were staying is effectively about 10 or 15 minute walk away from the Indica bookshop. So some 60 or so or 70 or so years after T.S. Eliot and Bertrand Russell were living in this flat in so some 60 or 70 or so years before these two relatives of the Eliot Asher family were staying in this flat, and Bertrand Russell, of course, being this forefather of the British counterculture movement, some 10 or so minutes walk away, some 60 or 70 years later, there was this Indica bookshop, which was partly owned by Peter Asher, their relative. And the Indica bookshop and was certainly a catalyst ground for the burgeoning 60s counterculture scene of London. It's where they all met. It's where all the key movers and shakers, like this John Hopkins guy I mentioned, he would have been hanging around there. The Beatles were hanging around there. In fact, Paul McCartney gave money to make this shop come into
Happened.
fruition, to make it happen. And accordingly, the payback was Paul McCartney and the rest of the Beatles were fed a lot of this countercultural knowledge that they then transmitted to through the Beatles and to the rest of wider society. And it helped, I would argue, I would suggest it helped to shape the culture of the 60s, and we're still living in that today. So this was a shop that championed the counterculture scene, and in tandem with that, it was a champion of the avant-garde as well. So it sold avant-garde books and records, and it also sold books on the occult. It sold books on Crowley and so on, and other books as well, such as The Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary. And yeah, John Lennon, on a visit to the shop, he was given a copy of The Psychedelic Experience, and that inspired him to record the song Tomorrow Never Knows, which appeared on their 1966 album Revolver, which you could argue was one of the first, if not the very first, LSD pop song on record. And yeah, and the Indica Art Gallery, which is somewhere in another location, again partly owned by Peter Asher, is where John Lennon was introduced to Yoko Ono, who was also into the avant-garde. That's how she started her career. She was an avant-garde artist, so he was introduced to her, and that set him off on that avant-garde path, if you like. So again, the Indica was there influencing the Beatles' artistic direction, if you like. And it was also the Indica bookshop in Bloomsbury, if I'm not mistaken, was also in the basement. It was where the very first British underground newspaper, the International Times, the IT, that's where it started its life, in the basement, I think, in the end of 1966. And that was started again by John Hopkins, John Hoppy Hopkins, this guy who I mentioned earlier. So yeah, so there you go. That's pretty much everything I've got to say.
I think this is actually an introduction episode of its own.
It is, and I feared it might be. So
So, well, I didn't fear. I realised what was going to happen, but I think
we
it'd be a
have to.
good. I think it'd be a good introduction episode, as in release this one first. Get a
Okay.
taster to what we're going to do,
Yeah.
and then I can. We'll just before we go, we'll just talk about the. I will play the audio after we've spoken about it in this episode, right? In
Yeah.
the introduction episode, but I will also play it right at the beginning again, for people to hear at the start of the episode we're talking about that you're going to hear. I'm going to release them on the same day, to be honest with you. We
Yeah,
should do,
just
yeah. Just release them both on the same
a
day.
video bomb. A
Yeah, video bomb.
video bomb. Do you want to mention William Sargent as well quickly?
Do you know that's one of the most exciting episodes I think we're going to do at some point is the MK Ultra stuff.
Yeah.
Sergeant Humphrey Osborne, were it Osman, whatever
Humphrey
they
on
got,
Osmond, yeah.
yeah, and all the other people, even the Lieutenant Olsen, who was, I found, I don't know if you knew this, but I found that he was sequestered, is it sequended or whatever, seconded, that's it,
Sequestered,
seconded,
seconded.
whatever, them two words, to William Sargent.
I never knew that until this year
Yeah,
when I
so
read the book. I can't remember the name of the book, but it's by John Stott.
yeah. I mean that part alone, I mean, again, they talk about coincidences. It just can't be coincidences. Anyway,
Yeah,
but
just to mention, but basically that William Sargent basically was a psychiatrist, a British psychiatrist, and during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, he was effectively made head of a part of a, he was a ward in a hospital or a department in
in
St. Thomas's Hospital, hospitals.
yeah.
But he, where he, his main place, his main HQ, if you like, was he also worked in Harley Street, but he had this St. Thomas's Hospital in London. Was where he was a head of a department as a psychiatrist, a mental ward, as you would have called it back in those days. I think it was Ward 5 was where he
Yeah.
did most of his work. But basically, the mind-blowing aspect of this for me is the fact that he was given carte blanche to wipe the memories of
Anybody?
mentally ill patient of anybody who came into that hospital in that particular part of the hospital that he was in charge of. So through a mixture of ECT, a cocktail of drugs and hours of sleep, quote unquote therapy, he effectively wiped the memories of dozens of patients. And this was, and what freaks me out is this was happening in a national health hospital.
Yeah,
This wasn't a
and
private hospital. This was a state-funded
it,
British hospital.
yeah, and it was happening in several different hospitals in or around London, weren't it? Well, you can only guess even more hospitals because a lot of these people who were trainees under Sargent went scuttled off in their own little directions to other mental health hospitals. You
And
can
St.
only,
Thomas's was the main one, was one of, was the one that we're most aware of. But where's that one that celebrities go to? He
The
worked
Priory.
there, the Priory. He was working there in the 60s, 50s and 60s, I think.
Again,
This is,
why wouldn't you? I mean, all these stars are coming in, alcoholics, addicted to drugs, depressed. Why wouldn't you have a MK Ultra expert doctor there just to reprogram Mick Jagger as he comes in, or Keith Richards?
Or
I'm
Marianne
not saying he
Faithfull,
did.
or
I'm not saying he did. I'm just using that as an
Well,
example.
Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein stayed at the Priory shortly before he died.
Right, sounds
So,
like Jack Ruby, but anyway, that's another story.
yeah.
But yeah, so explain the video, the 2 minute or whatever it is recording of Bertrand Russell. He gets asked a question, doesn't he? It's about the Pugwash conferences were about getting rid of nuclear weapons. Yes, it weren't about a cartoon on BBC in the 70s. It was about the
Was it a conference?
nuclear
Was it?
disarmament, nuclear disarmament, using all the academics of the time, Einstein, etc. And Bertrand Russell was one of the heads of this Pugwash conference, held in Pugwash, Canada, the initial one, anyway. Right? It's called Pugwash. But so a guy asked him a question, basically.
It was a press
Think
conference or something, wasn't
yeah,
it?
the culmination of the question was, even if we get rid of nuclear weapons, we need a one world government or something like that.
And he agreed.
He agreed and actually talked about it further on in his conversation. And he was a pusher of a one world government as well, weren't
We'll go into that in the first
he?
instalment quite a
Yeah.
bit, won't we?
So,
He was well into all of that. There's
yeah.
so many speeches I've read of his, where he effectively keeps, well, not effectively, he just in your face is
Yeah.
saying what we need is a one world government, an international organization. He used different names,
Spectre.
but yeah.
I mean, I've tried to improve the sound because it obviously it's 19 whatever 50s or whatever it was. I think it was
Yeah, the
1956 or 7 or it might be even
yeah.
earlier. The first Pugwash conference was, and
Yeah, I can't remember now.
so the guy asking the question, it was pretty low, so I've cut it and increased the volume a little bit, but
When did Einstein die? Because he was part
can't
of the
remember.
Pugwash, because he, was it Bertrand
Him
Russell
and
and
Bertrand
Einstein,
Russell, yeah.
yeah,
The
were part
manifesto.
of the, they wrote the manifesto. The year, I think the year that the Pugwash conference started is the year that Einstein actually died. So it's
Okay.
that year. So but I don't know what year that was.
Yeah. Well,
Not sure.
yeah. So there you go. So that's the intro. And only an hour and a quarter or something like that, I think. It's now quarter to
I just,
12. It's now quarter to
yeah.
12. So anybody thinking, how do I do this research? It's quarter to 12.
Yeah, and I'm going to go off and do some more now.
Yeah. Well, I've been at it all day writing, well, most of the day writing my book. Yeah. All right, then we'll leave it there. You might
Yeah.
need to rewind and replay this audio, just to, because the words don't necessarily jump out, because it's an old recording, going on bloody
Yeah.
80, 90 years old. So,
Yeah, it's a bit choppy.
yeah. Okay. Enjoy
All right.
the recording, and I hope you enjoy the first instalment. Let us know what you think.
Lord Russell. Lord Russell.
Yeah.
You say that imperative almost is politics be kept out of this. But is there not a political question that is bound to arise in the minds of the statesmen? Are they not bound to ask, can you envisage a scheme of disarmament and the wiping out of nuclear weapons which would not deliver the free world into the hands of communists as long as men can still fight with sticks and stones, people will say? Isn't the only answer world government?
Well, I'm entirely in agreement with you. I don't think prohibiting nuclear weapons in itself is the slightest good. You could prohibit them and have a universal agreement to prohibit them, and they would still be used if ever there was a war. And I don't think there's any point whatever in mere prohibition. The only thing that is any use at all is not to have a war. And as I said, suggested at the tail end of what I was saying, we can avoid war by expedience for the moment, but ultimately we must have some international authority which is able to prevent war. That is the ultimate goal, but it'll take some time to reach that goal, I think. But I do say most emphatically that merely to prohibit nuclear weapons won't get you anywhere at all.
Young before my life.